Okay, we are going to conclude now with Ramosha Kunitz for a few minutes, and then we're going to move on to Rameir Simcha of Divinsk. That's his picture right there. I'll pull it up again in a little while. I'll close it now. I do want to respond to a question, though, that I was asked about something I said last class. I mentioned the Sefer, the Ben Yochai, and how Rav Yaakov Emden, in the very first comment about the Zohar, refers to a snoga, or a shnoga, referring to a synagogue, and says it's a Spanish word, and therefore this is a proof that, and it's not just that he mentions the word, there's a whole drasha they derive, and therefore this is a proof that the Zohar is old. So someone asked me to clarify, Zohar's, at least that part of the Zohar is medieval. So someone asked me to clarify something about this. So let me just explain that what I said was ridiculous is what Kunitz writes when he claims that the word esnoga or eshnoga, he reads it eshnoga, is actually an Aramaic word. The truth is that there's a lot of nonsense in Ben Yochai, in the work Ben Yochai. However, in terms of Yaakov Emden's disproving the date of the Zohar, although this is a famous example of what he says, this is, I think, perhaps one of the weakest examples, and even not a valid example, because the word synagogue is actually a Greek word. It doesn't mean a place of prayer, it means a place of gathering, and therefore there is no reason why a work written in the days of the Mishnah would not use a term like that. So if you want to find examples in Rabbi Yaakov Emden showing post-Tanaitic examples from the Zohar, there's loads of them, but it turns out that the most famous one, right at the beginning of the Mitpachat Sfarim, is not such a good example. Okay, let us move on. I just, as I said, want to do a few more things of Kunitz, finish him up, and move into Rav Meir Simcha. I mean, many of you listening to me about Kunitz are probably thinking, well, he has some liberal things, and he does have some liberal things, but I mentioned a few, quote, conservative things already. Another one, which I was looking through the Masareth today, and I saw, I'd forgotten about this, he's very opposed to women's Torah study. Now, women's study was something that all the Maskilim were in favor of, then the German Orthodox types. He says, no, absolutely not. Chazal already tell us that there's no place for women in Torah study. There's an expression that the place of the woman is to sew. That's her job. Therefore, we don't listen to women when it comes to Torah matters. And Kunitz, I was a little surprised to see, adopts this position completely. This notion that the only role of a woman is, you know, with the spindle, which you often see Orthodox spokesmen give all sorts of apologetic answers for this. There's no need for any apologetics. It means what it means. And as with so many other areas, there's not one comments, and you even find, I'll give you an interesting example, there's everyone who wants to talk about predecessors, learned women, and there are some very learned women that you have, for example, the Prisher, the Sama, that he's the commentary in the Shulchan Aruch by Falk. He quotes his wife as giving an interpretation as to dealing with lighting the Yom Tov candles, and it's famous. Not so famous is that the Magen Avraham, not only does he feel the need to reject this interpretation, before he rejects it, he says, or after he rejects it, he says that don't pay any mind to this. There's no wisdom for women except for when it comes to the spindle. So we have, I don't know if you want to call them misogynistic statements, but we definitely have viewpoints that don't reflect what I think most people today, at least the people listening to us now, view about the role and ability of women. And Kunitz, for all his open-mindedness, didn't have an open-minded view when it came to women and Torah study. But he did have an open-minded view, or I should say a quasi-Haskala view, in another area. In discussing, this is in Hamatzari Volume 1, in discussing what it means to be a Talmud Chacham, He says that you cannot be a Talmud Chacham, a scholar, unless you know all 24 books of Tanakh. It used to be there was a time when Talmidei Chachamim studied the Bible. And in the Sephardic world, they always did. But already in medieval times, in the Ashkenazic world, they got out of it. They said that the Talmud consists of Bible also, so we don't need to spend our time studying the Bible. This became, and then when the Maskilim were Pakid Esrim Arbaas Farim. And Kunitz quotes this. Rashi says that a Talmud Chacham, to be considered a Talmud Chacham, it's not enough to know the Ketzos and Reb Chaim Soloveitchik and the rest of that. You need to be learned in all books of the Bible. And it is very hard today, certainly in the Ashkenazic world, to find a Talmud Chacham who can tell you that he has actually studied the book of Daniel or the book of Job. Or the book of Malachi. The only things they know from these books in Tanakh is if they're read as a Haftorah. And yet Rashi says that one needs to study these. Let me just give you an interesting example of this, which happened to me earlier today. I get these phone calls from different people. I was mentioning that he told me that something crazy someone said about the Holocaust. Why the Holocaust came, first, whoever sins it were. And I mentioned that Rabbi Soloveitchik always pointed out that we have to, in matters like this, we follow the viewpoint of Eov. And I explained what I meant. Now, I didn't talk to this person. I didn't ask him, does he know Eov's position or anything like that. But I have encountered numerous times when I said the same thing. I said that you don't ask. You don't give explanations as to why something like the Holocaust happened. And I said, that's the lesson of the book of Job, Eov. And these are Talmidei Chachamim have no clue what I'm talking about. And I explain that Eov was going through all these difficult things, and his friends thought that they could determine, they could say why, you know, he was doing, this was happening. Cannot determine that this is happening because of this sin or that sin. And therefore, as Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out, the only answer for the man of faith is silence. Understanding that there's things that we can't understand. And, this is, I think, a very important lesson. But how many people study the book of Eov? Baruch says, Chazal say, just like a Kala has 24 Kishutim, so a Talmud Chacham needs to be Baki in 24 Sfarim of Tanakh. And that's what Rashi quotes. That's the Rashi right here. Rashi's quoting the Chazal. By the way, I see I picked up my paper here. One other thing I wanted to make before we began. I was speaking about the Dohani Shul, and I said that I was there and during Sphira, and they were not playing the organ. I was there in the summer, so I wasn't Sphira. I don't know what they do during Sphira. I was there, though, during the 3 weeks. And during the 3 weeks, they didn't play the organ. So, for those who were on the trip, one of them emailed me saying, wait a second, we were not there during Sphira. Again, Kunitz then quotes the Beis Yosef, who quotes from Amram Gaon, one of the Gaonim, that even a shochet and a bodek, people involved in slaughter of animal, they need to be learned in all of Tanakh. In Hamatzaret, Volume 1, Number 55, we see another lenient decision of his, defending the Pesach of Ramosha Mintz, permitting kitnios in difficult times. Maybe not so surprising, but then we get another, I don't know if you have any doctors listening to us now, but we get a very interesting tshuva, Volume 1, Number 23, in which he says that a moel should also be a doctor. This is a very modern thing, that you have a Moel who's also a doctor. I know Moelim. They don't like this at all. You have certain Moelim who advertise that they're also a doctor. And the Moelim are upset with this. I mean, they see the competition, but also their attitude is like, what does being a doctor have to do with anything? We have just as much training in this area as doctors. They don't like it, because they don't think it, when the Molin don't like it, when a Molin makes the point that he's a doctor. I know a Molin who's a doctor. But Kunitz says that this isn't a modern thing. You had people in the 19th century also would think this. He says it's not a modern thing. The Gemara, if you look in Sanhedrin 17b, it says that a Talmud Chacham should not live in a city that does not have a doctor. And on the spot, Rashi says, if you just read it, the simple meaning is that you can't live in a city that doesn't have a doctor, because if you get ill, what are you supposed to do? Rashi says, quote, a doctor to circumcise their children. So we see, Kunin says, that even in Talmudic times, the Mole was also a doctor. And Rashi, I found, repeats this a second time in his commentary. Now, in Avodah Zarah, now this tshuva of Kunitz was sent to a doctor who was performing circumcisions, and he was very busy, though. He wanted to stop. He didn't want to do it anymore. He figured his Molin, they could do the circumcisions. And Kunitz tells him he must continue to circumcise because he is the most qualified in it. I have another piece sheet down here. Okay, I remember it. A couple more tshuvot. Hamatzari, Volume 1, Number 89. I think this also shows the temper of the man. I have a bit of a cold, so if I'm sneezing, you'll understand why. He's asked about Jews calling their children by non-Jewish names. In Germany, you always had a Jewish name and a non-Jewish name. But so he was asked about it. And someone had claimed in Hungary that this was forbidden. We already discussed this in our classes on Ramos Shafayin here. Moshe Feinstein says it's not an appropriate thing, but there's nothing wrong with it, and Ramos Feinstein mentions the name Maimon, which he just sensed was not a Jewish name. He could have mentioned many other names, names like Tarfon and Dosa, etc. But Kunitz has a long, long list of names. He just lists them all together with the source. This is on page 58 and 59. I don't know how he was able to do this, unless he literally went through every single page of Bavli, or Shalmi, and Halachic Midrash. He goes through and lists what he puts forth, I think, as a complete listing of all the sages. Let me just give you some of the names here that have non-Jewish names. He just gives you the name and goes on, and the page number. Rav Illis, Rav Puga, Rav Aputrimi, Rav Bali, Rav Vastini, etc., etc., etc. Rav Biros, see, he does it alphabetically. Krispadai, he's going by Masechta. Yeah, it's alphabetically, I think. Rav Philippa, and page after page of this, column after column. We have in the Tosafos also. I don't remember if we ever mentioned it, that there is a Tosafist whose name is Pei Tet Resh, Rabbi Peter. There was an attempt made by Hirsch Jacob Simmels to argue that this really is from Pater, like father or something, like Rav Abba. But we know we even have an inscription, and we know that it's Rabbi Peter. It's a famous story, a true story, not a fake story. One of the Agudas Rabbanim, or maybe it was an Agudas Yisrael convention, someone made a negative comment about Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld's name, that why does he, publicly he made his comment, why does he use the name Fabian? I mean, Fabian Schoenfeld, a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik, a rabbi in Queens for many years, he actually gave the opening benediction at the Republican National Convention. When was this? It was 1984. In fact, I told this, I remember telling this to Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he got very excited, because he said that when he first came to Boston, whenever the politicians would come to town, they have to bring the Reform Rabbi out to speak, represent the community, because the Jews couldn't, the Orthodox rabbis couldn't speak proper English. And he knew Fabian Schoenfeld very well. So he asked him, why do you have this name Fabian? And Rabbi Eliezer Silver defended and says that we have a Tosafist whose name is Rabbi Peter. And Peter is definitely a non-Jewish name. Now, Mark, my name, I actually spell it with a C, so it's not the Greek way, it's the Latin way. With the Greek, already you have an Old New Testament, but plenty of good Jews are named Mark and Peter and even Matthew, Luke, yet I haven't yet seen any good Jews named Luke. But yes, Petronius, but it is the name, you can pronounce it any way you want, but... And you could say Petzer, maybe firstborn. That might even be what, if, now that I think of it. No, Simmels thinks it's from close to the name Abba. And maybe someone says he was named because he was a firstborn. But the meaning of the name really is Peter, Rabbi Peter. And if you had Tanaim, if you had Amoraim and Tanaim, who had non-Jewish names, it shouldn't surprise us if you have also some rabbis in medieval times who have non-Jewish names. And as I said, once you get to German Orthodoxy, they have the Jewish name and the non-Jewish name. So the Matei Levi, you have Marcus, and they have Mordechai, and that's pretty standard. Sometimes the names are biblical, so you don't really see the difference, but other times they're not. Yes, it does mean a rock in Greek. Let's see. Okay, one more thing from Kunitz. I want to point out that Maskilim, Grammarians, and Gedolei Yisrael all wrote to him. And that's why the volume of Tshuvot, I said, is so interesting, in that you have questions you don't have other places. I mean, we're coming up to Pesach, so let me just give you one other question. He asks a very, he writes this question, which Maskil? Let me see, it's in volume 2, number 231. It's to one of the Maskilim, if I recall correctly. It doesn't say who it's to, but he wants to. Why does it say in the Haggadah, Ma Nishtana Halayla Hazeh? Why Ma Nishtana? Why not Lama? Now, what Ma Nishtana means really, what is this night different? It seems to be more grammatically correct to say Lama Nishtana. Why is this night different from other nights? And he has a piece here explaining that because this is working off Kishacha Bincha, when your son asks you Maha Eidot Chukim, why are all Eidot Chukim? What are, that's the Lashon and the Torah, what? So therefore the Haggadah uses this language. So in addition, you have Halacha stuff in this book, you have grammatical stuff, you have all sorts of stuff. So that is, and with this we conclude with Rav Moshe Kunitz of Budapest. Let me see the question, Baruch. Regarding doctors needed for Mila, mentioned the Gemara, according to Rashi, a doctor then, Talmudic time, wasn't the same as a doctor now. Medical education regulation wasn't the same as it is today. That's true. In medieval times, you have also the same thing. Who's a doctor? Oh, so many Gedolim are doctors. The Pachad Yitzchak, we're going this summer to Ferrara, and I'm going to talk a lot about the Pachad Yitzchak of Isaac Lampronti, who was also, in addition to writing the great Halachic Encyclopedia, he was a doctor. And according to the traditional biographies, maybe this is a bit of an exaggeration, but it says that he received his medical degree at age 16. But the point is, it was a lot easier in those days, and here we're talking in the 17th century. And he actually did go to medical school. What did it mean to be a doctor? I guess earlier times, you apprenticed, you learned a little bit. Most of the things the doctors did in earlier times would kill you before they would heal you. But nevertheless, the fact is they did have a notion of a doctor. And there was certain training. And they are saying, the Rashi's saying that you want someone doing Mila, who I guess if something goes wrong, is also trained in medicine. So this would apply very nicely today, and I don't see why there should be any problem if a Moel advertises himself as also a doctor based upon this Rashi, based upon what Rav Moshe Kunitz says. That's actually a Mila. I know that in certain circles it's not... It's a negative thing. You're implying that until now the Moelim were not good enough because they were not doctors, and those who follow the news know that a baby died a couple weeks ago because one of the Moalim did Mitzitza Bepeh. Apparently, that's the reason. They're looking into it now. This seems to be the initial judgment, and that's going to once again put a spotlight. We had this issue about 5 years ago. That's going to once again put a spotlight on this issue of moaling. Not that they have to be doctors, but they have to be aware of modern medicine and listen to what the doctors are telling them, because the moaling, especially in the more the Hasidic communities, pay no mind. The doctors could tell them today till tomorrow that there's a problem. They just don't pay any attention to this. And so if you follow the Jewish news, this is breaking news the last couple of days. There's going to be a lot written, especially if they can really show that this this death was because of the Metzitza B'Peh. Yes, Moalim today, they are certified by boards. But I don't know, what does that mean to be certified by a board? I think it means, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not a Moalim. Doesn't, what board are you talking about? The board of, in England, they used to have a board of a Mila. And that was to determine that the Moel knew what he was doing. And you need that. It shouldn't be, we should have in this country. I don't think we do. Just like we have hashkachas, and you can't open a restaurant unless you have a hashkacha. It shouldn't be that I can just open up, put a shingle in front of my door and saying I can do Mila, especially since Mila is a very sensitive operation. If I screw up, some kid's going to be paying a price for this. So we should definitely have, in Israel, your board certified by Shari Tzedek and other things. But I think that's more, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that's more to show that you have the skill. You know how to do proper Mila. What Ramosha Kunitz and what Rashi was talking about, I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, I don't think he was talking about when they say, now certainly not Kunitz, but I don't think Rashi, when he's saying a doctor, he's meaning someone who's, he's trained better in a mohel, and that's what it means to be a doctor. It means someone who has certain knowledge in addition to Mila knowledge. That's what a rofe is. Yes, in the UK and elsewhere, thank you. The baby died on, in September 11th. But it's only now, thank you for that information, it's only hit the news now, the last 2 weeks. I've only seen things about in the news. I don't know whether it's a suspicion or whether they've actually determined that there's some herpes or something that, and I think to determine this conclusively, we also would have to test the MOL. Because if the kid has herpes or something and the MOL doesn't have it, then you can't really blame Metzitza B'Peh. So, we'll see what develops with this. I haven't been paying that close attention, so I'm not sure of the details. Let us now move, unless there's any other questions. We're moving to our newest figure. That's going to take us also a few weeks, if not more, because we have with, let me get his picture up here again. We have not just history, and good history to speak about, Orthodox history. We also have, can't find the picture now, my picture of Rameir Simcha disappeared. Find it here. Ah, here it is. We have history, and we also have thought and all sorts of interesting things. Needle tells us the news agency discovered something that has long been determined by the New York City Medical Examiner's Office. The question is, what have they discovered? Has there been any and even if you tell me that it's conclusive that the child had herpes or that killed him, unless you also test the Moel, that is the Moel who did the bris and determined that he had this, you can make a suspicion, you can have a suspicion. Because where else would the baby get it? But I think you would need to test it, and I think by law you should be obligated to test it, because this Moel is doing every day, these Moelim are doing other operations, and other Milas, so I get to the bottom of that. We're dealing with Rameir Simcha of Divinsk now. As I said last class, he's one of the few people who's known by the names of two books. People refer to him as the Meshech Chachma, and they also refer to him as the Or Sameach. And I mentioned that not many people have this and these two names. But as soon as I finished the class last week, I said one was staring me right in the face. I didn't remember it. Joseph Caro, he's known as both the Beit Yosef and the Shulchan Aruch. The Rambam, of course, is only known as the Rambam. He's not known as the Arach HaZaka. And some people refer to his book as the Arach HaZaka. That's because when they originally started to, they thought that it was a bit arrogant of him to call his book Mishneh Torah. So they came up with another name, Yad HaZaka, and it fit in nicely because the Yud Dalid 14, there's 14 books in the Mishneh Torah. But the Rambam never called his book the Yad Chazaka, and anyone who respects the Rambam, I don't see why you would call it the Yad Chazaka either, because, as I said, the reason was precisely because they didn't want to call it the Mishneh Torah. And we heard some other people gave me some other names. Baruch says, is he wearing a tie there? Does he have payas? It does look like he has payas, a little bit of payas there. The tie, I can't tell. It looked to me like a scarf, a bit of a scarf. I don't think a rabbi in Dvinsk in the early 20th century would be wearing a tie. The little bit of payas, yes. As far as I know, we have other pictures of him, but as far as I know, they're just more face pictures. I think, let me see if I have one here. Yeah, the other pictures we have of him, I have another picture here. He's in traditional dress and face pictures. Who is Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk? He's one of these figures, by the way, that there aren't many like him that, with the passing of time, his reputation grows and becomes greater, and his works are studied and continue to be studied and are even more studied. As I've mentioned many, many times, that is not the normal way in life. That's not the normal thing that happens. And even among great, great Torah scholars, it's usually the case that their reputation declines naturally. And I could give names, and we have given names of people who in the 19th century, 18th century, were towering figures, and today no one's heard of them. But some, there's something about what they write or who they were. Rabbi Soloveitchik is a perfect example. Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg, the Or Sameach, Chazon Ish, whose reputation just grows and grows and grows. And others who were giants in their time. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. Rabbi Herzog, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein has nowhere near the popularity and significance today that he had in his lifetime. If he did, then no one would bother, they wouldn't have put this Erev up in Brooklyn. Now, when he was alive, he was able to stop that. And then we've spoken about this numerous times. So Rav Meir Simcha really falls into that very special category, which means that he is an eternal figure. His writings will be studied as long as Jews study Torah. People are going to be studying the writings of Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. He was a posek. He was a Talmudist. We only have one volume of his responsa. That's because much of it was lost. He wrote much responsa. He was a thinker. That's significant because most of the traditional Torah sages, they're not really known as thinkers. That's not what they spend their time on. Yeshaya Leibovitz, who we're going to have classes on Yeshaya Leibovitz, but He only really respected two 20th century rabbis. When I think of it, he didn't respect many people at all. He respected the Rambam. I think he liked the Maharal. He liked the Ramchal very much, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. And he respected, in the 20th century, Rav Kook, with whom he disagreed a great deal with, and the Or Sameach. That is the Meshech Chachma. He didn't study the Or Sameach, Leibovitz. But he knew the Meshech Chachma backwards and forwards, and he thought, and he is an extremely critical person, Yishai Leibovitz, he thought that the Meshech Chachma that's the commentary in the Torah by Rav Meir Simcha, was one of the most profound and original works of Torah commentary in modern times. Actually, I shouldn't say one of the most. He thought it was the most profound rabbinic work in the 20th century. Yeah, Baruch says about the Erev, they opposed it, but they wouldn't put it up when he was alive. There was a lot of, he had a lot of impact during his lifetime. And I've spoken before, I don't want to go through with it, there's all sorts of areas, even in the modern Orthodox world, or the quasi-modern Orthodox world. When Rav Moshe was alive, no one would have dreamed of questioning his heterim, for example, the heterim for whiskey. The OU a few years ago, about six, 7 years ago, put up a trial balloon that you can't rely on Rav Moshe anymore. And there's been other areas where people say you can't rely on Rav Moshe. And that's natural. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach also. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, one of his famous things deals with the Slifkin controversy, where he says that the position of Rav Avram ben Arambam is an authoritative position. And you cannot dispute it. You don't have to accept it, but you cannot say it's inappropriate. That is the view that when you study the, what the sages said, that you assume that everything they said about science was correct. 20 years after his passing, less, 10 years after his passing, no, 20 years after his passing, this is it 20? No, he died in the 90s. So 10 years after his passing, this position of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, which he set down in print, was not enough to save Slifkin and was no longer regarded as valid. So there's plenty of examples. Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, in a letter in the 1920s, which appears in the collected writings, Kisser Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, says that Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk is the Gadol Hador, the greatest sage of the generation. When you think of how many great sages there were in the 1920s, and for him to say that Rav Meir Simcha is the greatest, you're getting a real judgment there. Yidel says, yeah, that is the heter for Cholov Stam is being challenged. Sure, all these things are being challenged. Okay, let's continue. Let's go forward. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook said, he quoted the Altar of Slobodka, who he knew. The Altar of Slobodka comes to the land of Israel. And he quotes the, in the 20s, he quotes the Altar of Slobodka of Nassim Tzvi Finkel as saying, the Rechaim Soloveitchik was the Gaon, genius, but Rav Meir Simcha was Sar HaTorah, the Prince of Torah, which I think means that he stands even above Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Now, he wrote two classic works. One is the Or Sameach, commentary on the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, which in yeshivas is studied a great deal, and there's no question it too is a profound and important work. But I can't help thinking that there's lots of works like this, or I should say lots. There's a number of important works on the Mishnah Torah. The Meshech Chachma is more unique. The Meshech Chachma, the commentary on Chumash, the abbreviations of Meir Simcha's name is, you say Mem Shin Chet. That's where you get with the Chaf there. So it's Meshech. You take some letters of it, and that gets to the Meshech Chachma. It's not exactly, but the gematria of Meshech Chachma added up. The gematria of Meshech Chachma equals Meir Simcha. Who else from Meir Simcha's era? I'll get to questions, by the way, at the end of the class. I'll go back. I don't want to interrupt, though, the flow in comments. Who else from Meir Simcha's era wrote classic works that today hundreds, if not thousands of people study each week? Very unusual. Rabbi Cooperman of the Michala, it's the girls' school in Jerusalem, published an edition of the Meshech Chachma with a detailed commentary. There's a Rabbi Dome in Israel. He also wrote a detailed commentary. In fact, if you look at both of these commentaries without looking at the title page, you won't know which is which. They each look very similar when you open it up. If you're familiar with the Ritva, the editions of the Ritva published by Moshe Hadar Cook, they look very similar. On some of the pages, in fact, most of the pages, the commentary is more than the text itself up above. So here we're talking about each volume of the Torah, Bereishit, Shemot, Vayikra. You get one volume, the Meshech Chachma originally is one book. They've divided it now into five different ones with huge commentary, each one of them. What other commentary written in the 20th century can have a super commentary, two of them, which are quite expansive? Cooperman's commentary actually stays closer to the text than the other one, Dome's. But as I said, for each of them, there's more commentary on the page than text. Now, there is a famous yeshiva, a Baal Tshuva yeshiva. I don't know if there, I haven't seen any super commentaries like this on the Netziv. I've seen books that excerpt the Netziv, but I haven't seen a super commentary page after page with the notes just on each word of the Netziv. Could be, but I haven't seen the Cooperman edition. Okay, I heard he did it. I haven't seen it. But it's the same person. I don't know why the famous Baal Tshuva Yeshiva chose the name Or Sameach. If anyone knows, I should have looked on their website. I've looked in the past, I didn't see it. Why, out of all the people, it could be that the founder of it had a connection to it, but I don't know. But the name is, Yisrael has the answer. He heard that it was because he didn't have any children, and therefore the yeshiva takes the place of his children. Okay, very nice. Nice explanation, but it is unusual. I mean, anytime yeshivas are named after people, Chaim Berlin, Yitzhak Ochanan, it's because this yeshiva was founded shortly after the person died. Our Sameach is founded, when? It's founded in the 70s? You're talking 50 years after his death. It's not the sort of thing that you think, well, why pick him? There's other great Gedolim that didn't have children. You could have picked them either, also. Or children who survived. I mean, Chaim Ozer Grudzinski had no children that lived on. It's interesting. I don't think it's that, just that. If anything, it's probably that the person, people who found it, someone had a real connection, and therefore that was in addition. Let me start with the biography. Rav Meir Simcha, let me pull up a map here. Got a nice map, I think. Let's see if I can... Can't find my map here. I thought I sent up a map. I want to show you where he... yeah, no, I don't... for some reason, I... Ah, here it is. Okay. Let me enlarge it a little bit, I think. You see where... here, right here. Marked it. Where the arrow is, the X. That is where Rav Meir Simcha was born. It's the name of the city, town is Butrimonis. If I had to enlarge it to show you the where it is, and if you lost the name of it, but it's in the Kovno area. Lithuania, look to the right, you see Vilnius, Vilna, right in the middle of Jew City, I guess you could say. Lithuania, the center of Torah scholarship. His father was not a practicing rabbi. Let me erase this. His father was a businessman. But look how he describes his father here on the title page. His father is described as Harav Hamafursam. I don't know how famous his father was, but if his father was clearly a learned and educated person, because if his father was simply a balabas, just a simple merchant, he wouldn't have described him as Harav Hamafursam. He described him as Reb or something like that. The fact that he calls him Harav Hamafursam shows that at least among the people in the town, people who knew him respected him. And he does refer to his grandfather as Hagaon Hamafursam. Oh, for those who want to see where, I'll show it to you right here. Here. Let me get the arrow, my arrow. Right here. He refers to the... Notice how he refers to the grandfather as Hagaon Hamafursam, showing that the grandfather is not just a learned person, but the grandfather is a very learned person. A significant, very significant, put it this way, the father maybe is a minor league Torah person, the father is a major league Torah scholar. The grandfather, that is, he's a Gaon. And notice also, he calls him a Forsam Bedoro. This is also an exaggeration. If you think that, even if you went back to the 19th century and you think of, I think, who were the famous Gedolim, but he was known. So I guess you can call him a foursome. Among people, we might not know him, we might not see him as that significant, but among the Torah scholars of the time, he was recognized as a great Torah sage. There are people today, there are great Torah sages today, names who, if you're in the Torah world, you know, but no one else has heard of them. And even typical yeshiva students haven't heard of them, but if you ask great Torah scholars, they'll know that that this individual is a real scholar, and they respect him a lot, even though maybe he hasn't published anything, but they respect him. Also, look at the end, after his name, the father's name is Zichrono, after his name it says Zichrono Achaye, I don't remember how they do all those abbreviations, Zichrono Livracha Achaye Olam Haba, or something. That's what the first top one means, and the second one is Zechar Tzadik Livracha Achaye Olam Haba. So he throws in the Tzadik. he assumed, obviously, that his father was also a tzaddik, but when you refer to someone as zatzal, zatzal with tzaddik is only referred to as great Torah sages or someone who's is famous as being a tzaddik, like someone like Rabbi Aryeh Levin. But a typical Jew, a good Jew, will just get the Zion Lamed, Zichrono Livracha. And usually the woman won't even get that. Sometimes she will, but usually the woman will simply get the Ayin Hey, Aleha Shalom. If you don't measure up to the, usually it's the rabbis or the somewhat significant people who get the Zion Lamed, and the women and regular men, just your average balabas, he'll get the Ayin Hey, Aleha Shalom. Baruch says, regarding his father, he followed instructions on how to refer to his father after his passing. No, Zatzal, just Zal. That's interesting. I don't know how often people pay attention to this. It's interesting. I don't know. It's a good point. But I don't know. Doesn't the Rav Avraham ben Rambam even refer to his father with the tzaddik? I have to check. Good point. There are the typical stories told about him. He was a genius as is his child, all these sorts of things. We don't need to look into them. But what we see is that apparently all of his education came from his father. There is no record of him studying with anyone else. And he comes into that category of people, the Chazon Ish, Rabbi Soloveitchik, a few others, who I've made the point before, perhaps precisely because he didn't study in a structured setting. That's what enabled his mind to wander and grow. It's often that in these structured settings, people who have genius, it's crushed, and it's made conventional. Rav Meir Simcha wasn't forced to follow any sort of convention. Yeah, his family name was Cohen. Meir Simcha Cohen. I don't know, though, if that's what he uses in Hebrew. However, I don't know if in the vernacular, when he had to sign something in Russian, what name he used, if he used Kagan or something else like that. I haven't seen any record of it. At age 17, he marries. And he continues learning while his wife worked. This idea, which is so popular today, was quite uncommon in years ago. It wasn't that popular for the wife to work to support the husband. You have a few examples of it, but usually it would be the father-in-law to support the husband, and then when the father-in-law can't do it anymore, he gets a job as a rabbi. But this kolel idea that the wife works and supports the husband, that's Meir Simcha. That's how he lived. Within a few years, he had support from the family side also, but the wife worked, then it's recorded, to support him learning. Within a few years, they moved to Bialystok, important city of Bialystok. And during this time, his reputation begins to grow. He studies not just a couple years, he studies decades while his wife is working. We have Torah letters from him at the end of this period. Rabbis only write to you if you're recognized as a scholar. The earliest Torah letters we have from him date from 1882, when he's 39 years old. Here he's 39 years old. The typical Rav has already been a rabbi from the age of 19, 20, 21. He already has a position somewhere, 25 at the latest. He's 39 years old, and all he's been doing since his marriage, age 17, is studying Torah. This is unusual. He doesn't take a position until he's in his 40s. Now, when he was in the Bialystok, there was an opening. In 1883, there was an opening to fill the rabbinic position. It's Rav Shmuel Moliver, great Gaon, the leading rabbinic figure who was involved in Chum Beit Zion, and then religious Zionism, I guess you can call it. Not technically religious Zionism, because there wasn't a Mizrahi movement, but the precursor of religious Zionism. I think we can call it religious Zionism, even there wasn't political Zionism, but religious Zionism. Why, Rav Meir Simcha was once asked, why he wasn't chosen. And he responded with an interesting comment. All these things I quote, I'm quoting from traditional biographies and hagiographies. So that doesn't mean that everything is historically accurate in the sense that you can bank on it, but unless I see reasons otherwise, I'm assuming it's okay. Soon, when I speak about rabbinic conferences, machlokas with the Chafetz Chaim and other things, there we have real historical records, or at least we have reports from different sources. He said, we're told, that remember when Moshe Rabbeinu was on the mountain? And he's not coming down, and the people are wondering, well, is Moshe's gone? So you would think, well, if Moshe's not here anymore, where will they go to? Why create an Ego Hazav? Why create a golden calf? If Moshe's not coming back and you need a leader, go to Aaron, who was with Moshe all the time. Why not take the person you know? And Rav Meir Simcha says, precisely because they knew Aaron for so long, they didn't want him. They wanted something else. You know, people often don't want what's in their own backyard. And he said the same thing. He was in Bialystok. They knew him. He had been there for all these years. Precisely, they wanted someone else, someone new. There's a rabbinic phrase for this, a quasi-rabbinic phrase. It's quoted by the Chasam Sofer, as stated by the sages, Chazal. It's quoted by many others. Ein Navi Be'iro. There is no prophet in one's own, one is never, not a prophet in one's own town. There is no prophet in one's town. Well, the Chasam Sofer quotes it as a Maimar Chazal. The truth of the matter is that it never appears anywhere in Chazal, but it's a good teaching. It's probably good Jewish wisdom, but the only place we find it is in the New Testament. As we know, there's a lot of good Jewish wisdom that ended up, these were Jewish people, that ended up in the New Testament. If you look in one of the places in the commentary on Chumash, which is edited, so it has notes, where the Chasam Sofer quotes this as a Maimar Chazal, the editor says he doesn't know where this appears in Chazal. The truth is that a number of people quote this passage. There is no one is never a prophet in one city, but it was obviously in the air. I don't know when it enters Jewish literature. The Chasam Sofer is not the first one. It appears before him in Jewish literature. If I'm not mistaken, Shmuel Ashkenazi has that as an entry in one of his volumes, charting the history of when this comes into Jewish literature. But by the time of the Chasam Sofer in the 19th century, this was a well-known expression, which everyone just assumed was a rabbinic phrase from some midrash somewhere, but it actually is not. The position he took, when he finally took a position, was in Dvinsk. Let me show you where Dvinsk is. Also known as Dinaburg. Today it has another name, which I don't want to pronounce it because I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's a big city. It has about 100,000 people, I'm told, today. There it is, Daugavpils. I don't know how to pronounce it. But you see, also, it's Jewish Lithuania. Even though it's technically in Latvia, you would call that Lithuania. You see Panevėžys there. It's close enough to the border. It's the second biggest city in Latvia after Riga. He was appointed as Rav there. What do I mean appointed as Rav? Most of the time you're appointed as Rabbi of a city, you're appointed as Rav of the whole city. And then you maybe would have Dayanim under you, but you'd be the Rav. It's not like today where anyone can be appointed. You have a million rabbis in the city. You could have people with smicha, but there'd only be one rabbi, Rav of the city. Dinaburg, though, was different. Dvinsk. Dinaburg, the previous rabbi was, I mentioned the name Dinaburg because there was a famous Rav named Reuven. His actual name was Levin, but he's known in the rabbinic literature as Reuven Dinaburg. He was the Rav before him. There were two communities in Dvinsk. There was the non-Hasidic, we call it, I guess, the Misnagid community, although the phrase Misnagid in the early 20th century is not really a relevant phrase, because you don't have people self-categorizing themselves really as Misnagdim so much. But you have the non-Hasidic community, and then you have the Hasidic community. And each community needs a Rav. It wasn't always like this. You have plenty of places where you don't have your own Rav. If you're a Hasidic community, you have you follow the Rav of the city. He's not your spiritual leader, but in terms of Pesach, he's your Rav. In Dvinsk, it was big enough, and you had enough Hasidim that they thought that they should have their own Rav. And these were Chabad Hasidim. I don't know if this says anything about Chabad per se. I don't think so. I think it's really only in more modern times that Chabad has a tendency to want to be more separatist from... I shouldn't say that. They've always been somewhat separatist, but to create their own rabbis. And I know plenty of cities where the Chabad rabbi keeps a lower profile than we would expect from some of what we've seen, and listens to the halacha of the Rav of the city. But there are two kilot, Chabad and non-Hasidic. And when Rav Meir Simcha comes, he's calling in the late 19th century, 1888, I think it is, there's almost 20,000 Jews living in Divinsk. So it's a big city, decent size, in terms of Jewish life there. We're told, by the way, that when right before Rav Meir Simcha comes, Rav Reuven Levin Dinenberg died in 1887, and the one who gave the hesped for him, the eulogy, was Rav Yaakov Yosef, who was the Magid of Vilna. And he began, apparently, by saying that if we were worthy, today we would be saying Yechi Reuven, that appears in Devarim, chapter 33, but now we have to say Vayashav Reuven El Habor. Reuven returned to the pit, if you remember the story with Joseph, in the pit. So, as any good magid, any good maspid, he was playing on the words of the Bible. Rav Meir Simcha came highly recommended by rabbis of the time, and the community, I'll get to it, Baruch, in a minute, and the community chose him. This was unusual, though. Divinsk was a significant city, as I said, and you would think that they would choose a rabbi who had already served communities, a big community, or a middle-sized community. Going with someone who didn't have any practical rabbinic experience and never served as a rabbi was a bit of a risk, but they went for it. It turns out that there were some who wanted a more, as a big city, there was a more modern component there. When we dealt with Rav Chaim Moshe Grozinski, we spoke about the machlokes between him and Rabbi Rubinstein, between the modern element of the community and the more traditional element. You had the same thing in Divinsk. There were people who were pushing for a modern rabbi. When I say modern, we're not talking about reform or conservative or anything like that. We're not even talking about a German Orthodox rabbi doctor. We're talking about a rabbi, though, who knew Russian, for example, who could speak the language, who had some secular education. Rav Meir Simcha did not know Russian. And here he's a rabbi in Russia, in the Russian Empire. But they were not successful, and Rav Meir Simcha was hired. 1 year after Rav Meir Simcha becomes Rav, the Hasidim appoint their own Rav. And that is Rabbi Yosef Rosen, the famous Rugachever. I'm not going to say a lot about Rabbi Yosef Rosen, the Rugachever. We will have classes on him just to whet your appetite after we finish Rav Meir Simcha. Oh, let me pull up something here for you. I'm going to show you their graves. They're buried right next to each other, Rav Meir Simcha and the Rugachever. You can see it's obviously been redone. Okay, we're going to have, and there's a story. Rabbi Teitz was involved with this. Rabbi Teitz was from Latvia, and he had some connection to the Rugachever. He published the writings of his. He was involved something. I have to look. I'm going to take a look in his daughter's biography. He had something to do with, even during the communist era, they began redoing the grave. I'll make a note for that. I'll check on that. We're going to have classes on the Rugachever. After Rav Meir Simcha, I'm going to do Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, and I thought of doing the Ben Ish Chai, but I think instead I'm going to do Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector first. Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. We've done Rav Chaim Moshe Grozinski, and who I said was the most important rabbi in the Torah world in the mid-20th century. Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector has that role in the second half, or third, I guess, of the 19th century. So I'll do Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. I'm not saying anything about before. I'm just saying I didn't say this is the first rabbi, but they appointed the Rugachever Rav. And they would both serve together for many years and had actually a good relationship. They didn't fight like in many places. But I'm not going to spend time on the Rugachever. We'll get to the Rugachever. I think after I do Ritzo Achon, and I'll do the Rugged Shaver. They were very different. The Rugged Shaver and Rav Meir Simcha Devinsk were different night and day, but they seemed to get along very well. We are the Hasidim who were here, the Chabad Hasidim, they were of this branch. Now, if you look at Baruch's question, he says, which branch of Chabad? Breus, Kapus, Lubavitch. I'm going to talk a bit about these different branches because we have to take ourselves back to a different era. Today, most people don't know that there's these different branches. They just assume Chabad means Lubavitch. Next semester, when we do Rav Zevin was from also not Lubavitch. He was from a different branch. Today, these branches don't exist. However, there was a time when they did, and I will talk soon about them. It was the Kapus Hasidim, the Rebbe of Kapus. Kapus becomes really Babroisk, but there was a branch of Chabad, and I'll give the details. I'm going to give the details of where these branches come from in a little while, because we're going to speak about a rabbinic conference where this is important. But the Kapus, K-O-P-U-S-T is how it's usually spelled, the Kapus Chabad Rebbe, apparently, at least so it's recorded, he told his Hasidim that when they had halacha questions to ask Rav Meir Simcha, because it often was difficult to understand what the Rugged Shaver was saying. I find this hard to believe, because if they're going to be asking someone else, what do they need their own rabbi for? The Rugged Shaver himself was from Kapus Hasidic. So he was they appointed a Kapus, a Chabad type of rabbi, but not to ask him their questions. I don't know, that's what it's recorded. When Agudas Yisrael is formed, let me just go ahead a little bit here, in 1912, Rav Meir Simcha, they asked Rav Meir Simcha to be one of the leaders. He actually had a certain amount of sympathy for the Aguda philosophy, but he was not at the Aguda convention in 1912. His health did not permit him to go, and there was actually a time when he came into opposition to the so-called Aguda viewpoint, or at least the rabbis, who most of whom were allied with Aguda. There was a plan put forth by the Aguda that there would be 23 members of the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. There is this thing called the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, the Council of Torah Sages. Those who've been with me a few semesters know that I've said on numerous occasions that this whole thing is a fiction, the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. It doesn't exist. It hasn't existed for many years. Yitzhak Breuer, in his autobiography, writing in the 40s, already speaks about how it's a fiction, it's meaningless. What do I mean when I say it's a fiction? Yes, and there is, take Israel for instance, there is a so-called Council of Torah Sages. It's a fiction because, first of all, they never meet. They can go years and years without meeting. And second of all, it doesn't matter what they can meet or not. In the Aguda world, decisions are made by important individual rabbinic figures. For the Lithuanian world, it always was for someone like Rosh Hashanah. Today, it will be Rabbi Yoshev. For the Hasidic world, it will be the Ger Rebbe or the Belzer Rebbe. Belz is not a Guda, but that's how decisions are made. I have termed this the papal model. That is, that these groups find one great rabbi, and he makes the decisions. Originally, the plan was that you'd have a council of Torah sages. They'd come together, they'd discuss behind closed doors, and then they'd reach a decision by consensus. It never really happened, because there were always great rabbis who everyone else really gave them the right to make to decide authoritatively. No one was going to take on Rabbi Shach, and if he was going to take it on, it would lead to a split in Aguda, like with the Ger Rebbe. No one took on Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzinski. But originally, when there were all these high hopes from the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, they wanted to make it 23, which would correspond to the large Beit Din, you know, or the small Sanhedrin, whatever you want to call it in ancient times. The idea being that when we make a decision, this is authoritative. They still think it's authoritative. Just listen to the videos. Watch the video online of some of the spokesmen at the Aguda convention. It's a joke. This Rabbi Scherer and others, first of all, many people in the Lithuanian Torah world don't even go to the Aguda anymore. Many great Torah figures in the Lithuanian world don't go. But these guys getting up, talking about how everyone's obligated to listen to the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. We have greater Talmidei Chachamim, or Herschel Schechter. There's no one on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah who comes near him in Torah knowledge. And it wasn't always this way. You always had you always, it used to be in the Moetis, even in America, you had world-renowned Torah scholars. So, I mean, this idea that the Moetis is only a Torah somehow was putting forth Das Torah, and that everyone needs to listen to this, I mean, it's a joke. But there was a time when there were great Gedolim on it, and they wanted this mini Sanhedrin. Rav Meir Simcha came out publicly against this. He says that it is very arrogant for people to think in the Aguda that all of a sudden they're going to create a mini Sanhedrin here, a mini based on Agadol of 23, and that all of a sudden what they say is authoritative. The Chafetz Chaim, by the way, also came out against this, that you can have a Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, but you can't create it into some sort of Sanhedrin type like thing, which has an implication that what you say is binding on everyone. I see time has already run out. We're going to start next class about the most famous example of Rav Meir Simcha's involvement in Jewish causes, and although it doesn't concern the Aguda, he also takes what would later be seen as an anti-Aguda position, and a liberal, open-minded position, you might say, and this leads him into his great feud with Chafetz Chaim, and we will then, therefore, give you the answer, explain to everyone why Rav Meir Simcha is the only contemporary rabbi quoted in the Mishnah Berurah. All this next week. Stay tuned. Now let me go back to some questions. Do I have any questions? Let's see. Baruch says it was hard to travel and meet. Rabbis are busy too. Not sure what that's referring to. Yisrael says, did the Moetzes in America ever function like one? It's a good question. I think it did. I'm pretty positive it did. They used to meet. You had people of really huge stature, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rav Ruderman wasn't on it for a while because Rav Aaron Cutler kept him off. He had Rav Aaron Cutler. The reason I think it did is because we know about disputes that took place. There's one famous one where, I don't know if this is at the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, an official meeting, but it was the people who were on the Moetzes, where Yaakov Kamenetsky got so angry at Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein apparently wouldn't follow. They wanted some condemnation of Chabad, and Rav Moshe, for whatever reason, was always very sympathetic to Chabad, would never come out against them. And Rav Yaakov said, and this is mentioned by his son, in Making of a Gadol, that had Rav Moshe ever studied with the altar, that is, ever studied in Sabbatka, he would have had a completely different perspective. In other words, it's the fact that Rav Moshe Feinstein didn't study in Sabbatka that he's misguided when it comes to Chabad. But as far as I know, the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, they did have, they met, they argued. Yes, certain people were more significant. Rav Aaron Cutler is more significant. He was able to overpower lesser figures. But people put forth their positions. They met, and then they came out with a viewpoint, which then they advocated. And the most important thing is you had world-renowned figures on the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah in America. You had Eliezer Silver. You had Rav Aaron Cutler. It's a little hard to have a Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah where none of the figures are regarded internationally as internationally renowned. They're not even regarded as really renowned. In the yeshiva world, they're taken as they're important, but it's not like they've published anything. It's not like they're regarded as... they can pass in shilas, but they're not great spiritual leaders and everyone looks up to them. So you therefore have to create new ones. Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, if you've been following the Jewish news, you know that they're building him into, I guess, the Pope in America. He now is the man to deal with all issues, be it Orthodox gays or this or that. So it's Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. But I don't know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago even, I wouldn't have thought Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. I would have said maybe Rav David Feinstein or someone else. But, I mean, I don't think I'm being prejudiced if I say that the Rosh Yeshiva at YU, people like Rabbi Bleich and Herschel Schechter especially, and Willig and others, I mean, I don't think there's any comparison in terms of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah has always been you're appointed, two types of people were appointed to it. If you feel like a Weinberg already spoke about this. First of all, if you're a Hasidic Rebbe, you're appointed. It doesn't matter, you could be an Am Haaretz, but you have followers, so they'll appoint you to it. And second, if you're a Rosh Yeshiva, and the truth of the matter is today, to be a Rosh Yeshiva, you can inherit the position from your father or father-in-law. And now the Moetzus in America has a token position for a Sephardic rabbi. But if you look at some of the greatest Torah scholars in America today, they're not on the Moetzus. I'm even speaking about people in the right-wing community. You have plenty of people who are not involved in Agudah. So it's not what it used to be. And in Israel, as I said, they don't even meet anymore. It's a meaningless thing. The Lithuanian world has nothing to do with Agudah in any event. They broke with Agudah. But Yitzhak Breuer already, as I said, in his autobiography writing in the 1940s, spoke about how, and he was attentive to this because he was the Agudah theoretician. His father was the founder of Agudas Yisrael. He was the leading Agudah theoretician. So you can read how he writes about how there's no, the Agudah that they dreamed doesn't exist. Bill says, the Lubavitcher Rebbe supplied a sofer to write tefillin for Ramosha Feinstein. Yes, that's Ramosha Feinstein's. The Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote to Ramosha and asked Ramosha, why don't you wear tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam? It's a pious thing to do. Hasidim will wear it. And Ramosha said, first of all, we don't have to wear tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam. We decided halacha like Rashi. And that's that. That's the halacha. However, it is a nice thing to do, and I don't write it because I don't have it. And, if I had it, I'd wear it. So, the Lubavitcher Rebbe had him written and sent to him. The Hasidim who wear it, they wear it, they put it on, and then later they put on, the Rabbeinu Tam after they take off the Rashi. The traditional way of wearing it, and you still see this among Sephardim, is that you wear them both at the same time. Some of you listening have probably actually seen this. You have the two Shel Rosh and the two Shel Yad at the same time. If you go to the Kabbalist Yeshiva in Jerusalem, the Rav Yaakov Hillel's Yeshiva, if you go to the one, Shar Shamayim, you will see them do that. Today it's impossible to do it, because our tefillin are so giant. Just like everything else, the shiurim have exploded. Our tefillin are huge, they're like this. You couldn't fit two on your arm or two on your head. But take a look at what tefillin, how small they were. If you ever see your great-grandfather's tefillin, they were tiny, tiny tefillin. It's another example of how everything gets bigger and better. But even when we had small tefillin, as far as I know, Hasidim never followed this approach of putting on Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam at the same time. And I'm not sure why they didn't. I just thought of it now to mention it. I never investigated why not, because the tradition of Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam really is a Kabbalistic thing in the Sephardic world, and they always wore the separate one together. Yeah, Rabbi Belsky is just one example of, he needs a refuah shleima, of someone who is not at all involved in the Aguda. I don't know if he's not involved because he's scorned, or he's scorned because he's not involved, but you have Lakewood types who are not involved in the Aguda. Yisrael Kashkin says, I heard Yosef Brower declined an offer to join, no idea. You mean Breuer, Yosef Breuer. I don't know, He was definitely involved in the Aguda Yosef Breuer for a time. If you're talking about the Moetzes or not, he was definitely on the Moetzes. I shouldn't say definitely. My recollection is he was. Shimon Schwab was his successor, was on the Moetzes. I will have to take a look if Breuer was. I thought he might have been, at least for a time. Rav Soloveitchik was on the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah for a time when they first founded it. I will look into it. I have the biography of Yidel says, I think it's all documented as Sean Wyman's from Katowice to 5ER. You are absolutely correct, Yidel. There is a book by a Haredi figure, Sean Wyman. He's actually a lawyer. He's close to Rav Yashev. He has a book from Katowice to 5ER, and he has another book he published, which I have, in which he documents, not only does he document everything I've spoken about, he documents the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah functioning as an independent organization. He talks about the deputies in the Aguda functioning as independent of the rabbinic rulers. That is, the great rabbis gave, the whole idea of Aguda was that the Knesset members were supposed to also have no decisions. No opinions. They were simply supposed to follow the viewpoint given to them by the great Torah sages. And C. Wyman documents how on a number of occasions they go against this. and they decide on their own to vote for certain things, even though the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, we're talking about in the early 1950s when the Moetzes Gedolei Torah still functioned, the Moetzes said one thing, they said something else. If you want to be really disillusioned, if you're a Haredi and you want to be disillusioned with the Moetzes Gedolei Torah and with the Agudas Yisrael, all you have to read is Zvi Weinman's book. And Zvi Weinman, as I said, he's writing it as a Haredi figure, not just a Haredi, to the right of Agudas Yisrael, but he is a real historian, a real scholar. He uses original documents, archival documents, and the Satmar loved the book because it shows all the hypocrisy in the Aguda world. And the biggest opponents of Das Torah, of Lithuanian Das Torah, is the Satmar. I mean, the Lithuanians try to put forth this Das Torah. Everyone has to follow this Das Torah, and the Satmar would obviously be opposed to that. Any other questions before we end? Yisrael says, would moving from Lita to Latvia present a culture shock? Were they pretty much the same place? They were pretty much the same place. This Latvia, where he is in Davinsk, is Jewish Lithuania. Jewish Lithuania is quite broad. Mir is Jewish Lithuanian Poland also. It's the same culture, same rabbis, same Torah approach, no difference at all. It would be a culture shock if you moved to a place like Romania, or if you moved smack in the middle of Hasidic Poland, or if you moved to Western Europe or to Germany. But moving from in that part of the world, no difference. Really wouldn't even be a difference if you moved into Russia, even. Baruch says, Rameir Simcha's works that you highlighted were on Rambam and Chumash, not Halachic Responsa. No, but I said he has one volume of Halachic Responsa. We've lost. He wrote many, many more Responsa, which were lost. But he was a posek, and he was a halachist. And you will see, I'll give you one or two examples, how people have derived practical halachic decisions from the Or Sameach, the book of the Rambam. One or two more questions. I'll tell you next class, or the class after, something Rav Yehuda Amital, how he a very interesting practical halachic decision that he derives from the Or Sameach. We'll speak about the Or Sameach. The Or Sameach is such an interesting sefer. Who ever heard of another commentary from a traditional Lithuanian Torah scholar, a commentary on the Rambam, cite the Morin Avuchim, to deal with philosophical issues? I'll get to that, if not next class, the class after. There's a difference. Rav Chaim Brisker never paskened. He didn't write Chuvos. He had a Dayan, and he Simcha Zelig, he had others. Rav Meir Simcha, fine, there's every big city had Dayanim. If you have a chicken, you want to know if it's kosher, you don't have to bother the Rav, you go to the Dayan. But Rav Meir Simcha wrote Halachic Tshuvot. People wrote questions to him, and he wrote Responsa. He wrote many, many Responsa, but it's all lost. All we have is one volume. The Sri Deish, in that letter in which he says Rav Meir Simcha is the greatest, he actually says in the context of advising not to ask him a certain question, because this area, he's not going to want to get involved. It had to do with politics in Germany, separatism from the reform versus non-separatism. But he was known also as someone you could ask halacha questions to. Yes, Rav Zevin. We're going to get to this. Rav Zevin has a, in his book, Ishim Beshitos, has a whole chapter on Rav Meir Simcha. All coming. Naming Yeshiva Or Sameach is good marketing, Yisrael says. Is it? Why is it good marketing? I don't know if it's good marketing, and I dare say that I can almost guarantee you that 100% of all the students who study, who begin studying at the yeshiva, have never heard, don't know what Or Sameach means. Have never heard of Meir Simcha Davinsk. These are Balei Tshuva. These people don't know anything. So, I don't know. Is it marketing? Is it good marketing? I'm not sure. Okay. Very nice. If they use it, I don't know. I don't know if Arslaniak uses that. If they use it, very nice. But if you know the Kirov world, it's actually Arslaniak is the more of a dour place compared to Eish HaTorah. Eish HaTorah, it's all about fun and rejoicing and happiness and all you have to do is look at their nonsensical videos, which annoy me to no end. The Rosh Hashanah video, if you've seen the Rosh Hashanah video. As if any show in the world you go to, you're going to have people like that guy on the motorcycle dancing and everything Rosh Hashanah. It annoys me to no end, as I said, because you have to be honest and tell people that, yeah, Rosh Hashanah can be boring. It's a long service. We sit there, but that's part of the struggle. You know, and we don't do this very often. We do it twice a year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and try to bring in the non-religious by making it seem like they're going to go to show Rosh Hashanah and you're going to have the guy with the dancing around like it's Purim or something. And I think that video is really quite disgraceful. You never find Or Sameach doing something like that. Or Sameach is much more standard, Lithuanian, yeshiva. They actually have limits beyond which they don't believe in going, even in terms of Kirov. They're not honoring intermarried people. They're not, Eish HaTorah really is very, it's very different. Yes, it's much more serious. Okay, everyone. Amanda Eish HaTorah, as being the one with the videos and all this. Thank you very much, everyone. We have two more classes this semester. Have a nice Freilich HaPurim, and hope to see you all next week.